closed-door committee hearing after the trip. The Jupiters were located near a forest, without any protective covering, and brightly illuminated at night. They would be sitting ducks for a sniper. There were three Jupiters sitting there in the open, all pointed toward the sky, Holifield told the committee. Over $300 million has been spent to set up that little show, and it can be knocked out with three rifle bullets. Foreign personnel weren't supposed to enter the nuclear weapon igloos at NATO bases, but little had been done to stop them. A lone American soldier manned the entrance to the igloos, serving as a custodian of the weapons, not as an armed guard. Once again, security was provided by troops from the host nation, who also moved weapons in and out of the storage facilities. Senator Albert A. Gore Sr. could hardly believe the arrangement. Non-Americans with non-American vehicles are transporting nuclear weapons from place to place in foreign countries. It was one thing to entrust these weapons to the Strategic Air Command, with its strict operating procedures and rigorous devotion to checklists. But the competence of NATO troops varied considerably, and their level of professionalism wasn't the most important consideration when it came to guarding America's nuclear weapons. The prime loyalty of the guards, of course, is to their own nation and not to the U.S., the Joint Committee said. A nuclear weapon might be stolen by a deranged or psychotic NATO soldier, by a group of officers seeking political power, or by the government of a host nation for use against an enemy other than the Soviet Union. These scenarios were unfortunately plausible. A pair of NATO countries, Greece and Turkey, despised each other and would soon go to war over the island of Cyprus. Right-wing officers had staged two coups d'état in Turkey during the previous year, and Jupiter missiles were scheduled for deployment there in the fall of 1961. Covertly funded by the Soviet Union, the Italian Communist Party had strong support in the region where Jupiter missiles were based. Members of the party might seek to sabotage or steal a nuclear weapon. Concerns about theft weren't absurd or far-fetched. A few months after the Joint Committee's visit to NATO bases, a group of dissident French officers sought to gain control of a nuclear device in Algeria as part of a coup. At the time, Algeria was the site of French nuclear tests and a French colony fighting for independence. A nuclear test, codenamed Gerboise Verte, was promptly conducted in the Sahara Desert so that the officers attempting to overthrow President Charles de Gaulle couldn't get hold of a nuclear device. "Refrain from detonating your little bomb," General Maurice Challes, one of the coup leaders, had urged the head of the Special Weapons Command. "Keep it for us. It will always be useful." In addition to being loosely controlled by the United States, the nuclear weapons in the NATO stockpile were often old and poorly maintained. According to the Joint Committee's report, NATO had been turned into the dumping ground for obsolete warheads and weapons systems that were nevertheless placed in an alert position of 15 minutes readiness without adequate safety precautions. Congressman Holyfield estimated that about half of the Jupiters wouldn't take off if the order to launch was ever given. The missiles were complicated, liquid-fueled, and leaky. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff admitted that, from a military standpoint, the Jupiters were useful mainly for increasing the number of targets that the Soviet Union would have to hit during a first strike. "It would have been better to dump them in the ocean," Eisenhower later said of the missiles, "instead of trying to dump them on our allies." The Mark 7 atomic bombs carried by NATO fighters had been rushed into production during the Korean War, almost a decade earlier. The nickel-cadmium batteries of a Mark 7 constantly had to be recharged, and its nuclear core had to be carefully placed into an in-flight insertion mechanism before takeoff. The bombs were not designed for use during an alert. Once the core was inserted, a Mark 7 wasn't one point safe, and the bomb had to undergo at least 20 different diagnostic tests, increasing the odds of a mistake during assembly and disassembly. It was plagued by mechanical problems and seemed to invite human error. Harold Agnew was amazed to see a group of NATO weapon handlers pull the arming wires out of a Mark 7 while unloading it from a plane. When the wires were pulled, the arming sequence began, and if the X unit charged, a Mark 7 could be detonated by its radar, by its barometric switches, by its timer, or by falling just a few feet from a plane and landing on a runway. A stray cosmic ray could theoretically detonate it. The weapon seemed to invite mistakes. A rocket-propelled version of the Mark 7 was unloaded, fully armed, with its X unit charged, from a U.S. Navy plane in the spring of 1960. The ground crew had inadvertently yanked out the arming wires. An incident report noted defects in another Mark 7. During initial inspection after receipt of a War Reserve Mark 7 Mod 5 bomb, it was observed that the safing and arming wires were in reversed locations in the arm safe retainer assembly, i.e., the arming wires were in the safing wire location and the safing wires were in the arming wire location. Four screws were missing from the assembly. And a Mark 7 sometimes contained things it shouldn't. A screwdriver was found inside one of the bombs, an Allen wrench was somehow left inside another. In both bombs, the loose tools could have caused a short circuit. The risk of a nuclear accident at a European base was increased by the fact that the training and operating manuals for the Mark 7, indeed for all the weapons in the NATO atomic stockpile, were written in English. But many of the NATO personnel who handled the weapons could not read or speak English, and few of them knew what to do if something went wrong. In many areas we visited, the Joint Committee found, little or no explosive ordnance disposal, EOD, capability was available in the event of accidental radioactive contamination resulting from fire, carelessness, or accident, or in the event of threat to custody and security of the weapon requiring emergency disposal. Western Europe was more densely populated than the United States, and a cloud of plutonium released by a nuclear weapon could threaten a large number of people. The possibility of such an accident was far from remote, according to the Joint Committee. It cited a mishap on January 16, 1961, just a few days before Kennedy's inauguration. The underwing fuel tanks of a U.S. Air Force F-100D fighter were mistakenly jettisoned when the pilot started the engines. The plane was on alert at the Lakenheath Air Base in Suffolk, England. The fuel tanks hit the runway and ruptured. Some fuel ignited, and a Mark